Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming out today. We may have a few more people coming in, so if you do have a seat next to you and you see someone standing, please offer it to them. We unfortunately had to turn people away today because the event was very oversubscribed, I think for understandable reasons. Let me welcome you to the United States Institute of Peace. My name is Alex Thier, and I am a senior rule of law advisor here, and I co-chair our Afghanistan Working Group, which for the last, I think, 7 years has been one of the best places in Washington to come and hear about Afghanistan policy, to hear alternative and outside voices, and to hear, unfortunately, some of the difficult truths of what has been happening in Afghanistan over the last 7 years. I am truly honored and thrilled today to have a tremendous panel, which no doubt you all know, which is why you're here. I am not going to do a long introduction of our panelists because you do have bios in front of you, but I will just say briefly who they are and the order that they will speak in. First, we have to my immediate left Ali Jalali, who most significantly is an Afghan-American of real stature both here and in Afghanistan. He was Afghanistan's interior minister for several years between, he'll give me the exact dates, 2002 to 2005, some of the most critical years for Afghanistan's moving forward and attempt at recovery. To his left is Major General Peter Gilchrist, who sadly for us in Washington has been serving as the defense attaché in the British Embassy for the last several years and is leaving next week. The good side of that, however, is that he has promised to give us a no-holds-barred account of his time as deputy commander of the Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan in 2004 and 2005, so also an incredible amount of on-the-ground experience with the very problems that we're seeking to address today. To his immediate left is another Afghan, a remarkable man who is now the deputy commissioner, or deputy chair of the Afghan Human Rights Commission. I have known Fahim Akeem, for better or worse, for almost 15 years, where we worked together in Kabul, dodging Taliban bombs and making jokes under stress, which has continued to this day. And to his left, we have Mark Sedra, who is a young academic who has been doing fantastic work on Afghanistan over the last several years, has authored, co-authored, or co-edited several books on Afghanistan. In fact, his most recent book is just coming out, and this is in part a launching event here in Washington. It's called Afghanistan Transition Under Threat, and it is available for sale. I think that he's put information on the out in the front.
Unfortunately, I didn't, but
he didn't.
He'll say something
in his remarks about how you can get a copy. This is an edited volume with some great authors. The final plug before we get started, USIP has been running a project called the Future of Afghanistan Project, which will be coming out with an edited volume itself in a few months, which is meant to look ahead. It is not an assessment of the last 7 years or indeed an assessment of the next 12 to 18 months, which we seem to be stuck perpetually in, but rather is an attempt by some of the leading thinkers in the field, Afghans, Americans, people from around the world, to think about what Afghanistan could and should look like in 10 years and how we might think about getting there. The first essay of the series that we have released is available to you in draft form by Minister Jalali, called The Future of Afghan Security Forces. Let me just begin by saying that we have obviously had a monumental shift in the United States in the last few days, which is going to lead to increased and renewed attention on Afghanistan and Pakistan. The president-elect, throughout the campaign, and even, I believe, in a statement yesterday, indicated that Afghanistan and Pakistan are going to be among, if not the highest priorities of a new administration. And in many ways, that's great news, because I think that the attention and focus of the U.S. government on Afghanistan now is as critical or more critical than ever. At the same time, it is this week the 7th anniversary of the fall of Kabul. 7 years ago today, American and allied forces went into Kabul, largely, if not almost exclusively, welcomed by the population. There were a few warlords who weren't so happy about it. But for the most part, the Afghan people welcomed the international forces and the fall of the Taliban with open arms. It then became incumbent upon the new government of Afghanistan, formed in the bond process a month later, as well as the United States and international forces who had brought about this seismic change in Afghanistan, to deliver on a tremendous series of promises to provide security, to provide some modicum of development and prosperity, and probably most important, to provide stability to a people who had not known stability for a quarter of a century. And because of that lack of stability, it affected us all here in Washington, London, and around the world. So over the last 7 years, we have had an opportunity to make a tremendous difference in that country. And yet 7 years later, it is still the top priority on the president-elect's agenda. And that is not, unfortunately, for good reasons. It is not a priority because we've made so much progress in Afghanistan, yet it remains so near and dear to the hearts of the American people that we just want to do more. It has remained on the top of the agenda because of the bad situation that Afghanistan finds it in itself in, and indeed that we all find ourselves in 7 years on. Unfortunately, we had about 3.5 to 4 years of relative progress, and now we've seen about 3 years of relative decline. But I think it's important to remember that some of the seeds of that decline were in fact sown in the first 4 years. And the reason I say that is not to go back and lay blame, but it is rather to go back and look at the fundamental problems that we face in Afghanistan today, because if we are going to understand them and the way forward, we indeed need to understand why in 7 years the situation there is more dire than it has been at any point since the invasion. I believe that it's largely due to our combined failure to develop legitimate and capable government in Afghanistan. That means the lack of competent security forces throughout the country that could provide security to the Afghan people, that were trusted by the Afghan people, which did not prey upon the Afghan people. And that is the lack of the rule of law, the creation not only of a constitution, which is important, and institutions in Kabul, which are important, but indeed an ethic, a governing ethic that reaches all the way up to the top of the government and to the top of the international community, that Afghans henceforward will obey the rule of law, and that the most powerful as well as the most weak are subject to that law. Because the failure to do that will so fundamentally undermine the confidence of the Afghan people that they are no longer on board with the transition. This is also, I think, critically the failure to deal with Pakistan and the relatively unmolested sanctuary that Al-Qaeda and Taliban and other extremist forces have enjoyed in Pakistan, which allowed them to regroup, to rebuild, and then to look back to Afghanistan in 2005 and 2006 and realize that there was an opportunity for them to expand, to move back into Afghanistan. So, with this election, we have a fresh opportunity for fresh thinking. And I welcome all of you to hear, for the next hour, each of our panelists lay out their vision of how security in Afghanistan can be improved, and encourage you all. Unfortunately, President-elect Obama wasn't able to make it today, but I encourage all of you who may have connections to him and his future team to go and to provide these ideas. So without further ado, each of our panelists will present for 12 minutes, at 12 minutes they will be treated as a hostile witness so that we can leave plenty of time for question and answer. So I welcome Minister Jalali to start our conversation.
Thank you very much, Alex. I'm pleased to be here, and some of old friends and new friends. I was in Kabul last week and met with many people, and the major concern on people's mind is security. Security, building security institutions proved to be one of the most difficult tasks of the reconstruction of Afghanistan during the past 7 years. First of all, the environment was such that the Afghan government and its international allies had to do things at the same time, to build the state, build state institutions, at the same time fight insurgency and terrorism. Sometimes the there are competing demands between the building state institutions and also at the same time fighting the insurgency and terrorism. It is very easy to be focused mostly on tactical solutions at the expense of long-term priorities in that kind of situation. The other problem there was that in Afghanistan there was no capacity, 30 years of war, so many countries came to help Afghanistan. That was good, but at the same time it was very difficult to coordinate their efforts. Countries came to Afghanistan to build the security sector with different levels of commitment, different capacities and investment, and different procedures, different priorities. So that was another problem. So during the past 7 years, this was a major challenge, how to build indigenous security forces for Afghanistan. While the Afghan National Army was built by through the help of the United States with a lot of investment and attention, and the police did not receive the same kind of attention. And at the same time, the justice sector, which is connected to the police sector, it was also supported by another country, which came with other priorities. So the security sector reform was broken from the onset. Therefore, I'm not going to go back and give you the long list of mistakes made in the past and what we could do better in the last 7 years. I would like to focus on what lies ahead for the security forces of Afghanistan. First, it's what is the vision for security forces in Afghanistan? I think the vision is that to build a security forces that can not only respond to threats from outside, but at the same time to create a safe environment for people inside the country. When I say safe environment, that's the security, that's human security, actually, to free people from fear, to free people from want. Free people from fear of insurgents, from terrorists, from drug traffickers, from criminals, from corrupt government officials. In the same time, to free them from want, to provide job opportunities for people, services, good governance, and the rule of law. This is very important in the next 10 years in Afghanistan, because today in Afghanistan, 60% of population is under 20. And soon, I think it will 70% of population will be in the job market. By some calculation, it will be 5 to 6 million Afghans in the next 5 to 10 years in the job market. But now, the rate of the unemployment is in the rural areas, particularly, is 40 to 45%. In many areas in the south, these unemployed youth actually are targeted by insurgents, drug traffickers, and other criminal networks. So this is the issue, that the vision should be to provide a secure environment and the human security for people that can, in fact, respond to the needs of the emerging generation of Afghanistan. Now, I think the some of these tasks were outlined in the Afghanistan Compact, which was adopted by Afghanistan and its international partners in 2006 in London. And that in that compact, the security is defined as a combined effort of establishing good governance, development, and the rule of law. Now, what are the challenges that face Afghanistan in order to fulfill that vision? First of all, there are three major or four, I would say, four major challenges. First, insurgency. Insurgency is no longer only in Afghanistan. It's a regional problem. It is not a war in Afghanistan. It's a war in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, not only in Fatah, but also in settled areas. So therefore, unless this challenge is addressed, it will be always difficult to develop a kind of a security force for Afghanistan that will provide for what I actually said before, human security for the people of Afghanistan. And unfortunately, during the past several years, the fighting insurgency actually undermined long-term security priorities in protection of population of Afghanistan. Co-opting people who are themselves actually the source of threat to people in the interest of fighting insurgency became the source of threats to security in Afghanistan itself. Today in Afghanistan, criminality and insurgency are cooperating with one another. Afghanistan does not face insurgents; it faces an insurgency. That's good. And insecure, unstable environment where it is exploited by insurgents, by terrorists, by criminals, by drug traffickers, and by corrupt government officials. So therefore, responding only to insurgency or terrorism without paying attention to these other aspects actually is one challenge that is still facing Afghanistan. The other one is the lack of unified strategy for Afghanistan. These days, we hear that there's a review going on for a new strategy for Afghanistan. Usually people ask, they're talking about five elements, that's the more troops, talking to Taliban, or rearming or arming the tribes, addressing the regional aspects of the insurgency, and finally helping Afghanistan to establish good governance. But still, we don't know the details of this. Therefore, in the next 10 to 15 years, what actually matters in building security forces in Afghanistan are, first of all, to address certain issues. First of all, I would say that security forces cannot be built in Afghanistan in an effective way unless it is part of the state building. Without a good governance, without the rule of law, you build security forces, it's not going to help bring stability to the country. Emergence of effective governance that is underpinned by the legitimacy of state is actually very essential. Institutional loyalty and faith in serving the government are closely linked to the legitimacy, viability, and effectiveness of the government. So unless security, development of security forces is in the context, is in the context of state building, it cannot be built separately. Second, unless the security forces become a professional forces as a state institutions, not linked to interest groups in Afghanistan, it is not going to develop in a very healthy way. Today, still, unfortunately, in police and also in the army, local loyalties, ethnic loyalties, is still a problem. And it is larger because unless you have a stable state, the security forces cannot develop that kind of a culture where all other identities are melted into one professional identity that serves the state. So it will take a long time. The other issue is the fragmentation of security institutions, army, police, justice, and intelligence. These elements, unless you bring them together and bring a kind of a synergy in their operation, they cannot, sometimes they work at cross purposes. Today, that kind of unification of the impact of all these institutions is not there. The other problem that in the next 10 to 50 years will matter a lot is addressing corruption. In addressing corruption, I think a lot is said about this, and the corruption is rampant in Afghanistan today because there's a mentality of survival. Survival actually go hand in hand with corruption. There are some plans for corruption, but not effectively implemented. I think the corruption should be addressed strategically, which means prevention, surveillance, investigation, and sanction. It is fragmented today. There's an office of fighting corruption, but there's no link between that office and other law enforcement institutions. At the same time, I think there's a need for getting involved, public, in fighting corruption and police particularly. I think an ombudsman and involving local institutions or public institutions and selection boards of police, establishing an ombudsman of police, establishment of commissioner of police, these are all issues that are needed, but there's nothing being done to bring changes in the area. And then mandate of police. Today there's no clear mandate for police. Is police a counterinsurgency force, or it's an instrument of the rule of law? Because of this problem of insurgency, police is being used as a counterinsurgency force, and that actually undermines its duties, its role in the protection of population. There are some thoughts about reconstruction of police. However, I think in the long run, there should be two kind of a police, like what Afghanistan had in the past. One is a more robust, stronger, and well-equipped police for the borders, for fighting criminality, and also in rural areas. One civilian police to actually act as the instrument of the rule of law. Then the time. It takes time to build professional security forces in Afghanistan. You cannot build in a few years. I think it takes decades for the army to be built as a professional institution, also for police. However, sustainability comes another problem. This year, the budget of Afghanistan, the annual budget of Afghanistan, is $1.2 billion. With some addition, it is not more than $1.4 billion. While the cost of a security force in Afghanistan today is more than $3 billion a year. Even if all the revenue of Afghanistan is spent on police, it cannot sustain it. So it is a long-term project, and then long-term commitment of the international community to build security forces. And finally, the building of security forces can achieve its goals, the vision that I said before, while it is part of an overall state building strategy, which fighting insurgency should be part of that state building. Transition from Afghanistan from instability to stability is actually the challenge of state building. The security forces is part of that state building. Thank you very much.
Thank you. General Gilchrist. Well, Alex, thank you very much indeed, and thank you to the United States Institute for Peace for laying on this series of seminars under your guidance. I am going to disappoint you, I'm afraid, because there are too many witnesses here for me to tell you exactly what you might want me to tell you. So bad luck. Now, I think I'd like to start off by saying and reminding us all, and I've taken a theme to be a challenge for the new administration, how will we advise them to, what are the things they need to do. Afghanistan is a non-discretionary intervention, and we need to remind ourselves that for a good number of years, right up to the late 60s, Afghanistan was a relatively peaceful, settled country with a stable economy, and the people, I think, had a relatively good life. And when you talk to Afghans, they sort of look back at that as being a sort of the high spot. And it's really our responsibility after all the interference, and I'm not going to go through the history, but we've all interfered in Afghanistan over the years, my country as much as any country, probably more so. And we they do deserve to get to that position of stability. And I, therefore, looking back at that, certainly don't subscribe to some of the worst press commentary, which says this is we're into a complete failure in this at all. So I'm absolutely clear that there's a way through this. But there are some things we need to do if we're not to make it an awful lot more complicated for ourselves than it is already. And it does appear, I agree with Alex, to have got more complicated in the last 3 years than it was when I was sitting there with Ali Jalali as the Minister of Interior back in 2004-2005. And I thought I'd just go through a few of those things. I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is we've really got to get out of the short-termism brought about by the election cycles, but not only here, but in Europe and obviously also now in Afghanistan. That leads to some bad behaviour. And we really owe it to the Afghan people to demonstrate to them that we are committed to them for the long term and not just for the period of a particular election. And that is an important thing that we just have not got through. And to do that, we need to improve our strategic communication so that they really do understand that fact. And I think if you go around Afghanistan, there's still lots of wonderful theories about why we're there. None of them, sadly, normally equate to the truth. From the international community's point of view, and here there are a lot of common themes with what Ali said, is we have to tighten up the command and control of the military. Not only the military, but also the provincial reconstruction teams. They all need to come under the command of a single military commander. That commander should be General McKiernan as the NATO commander, and he ought to be properly authorised to give that unity of command and coherence that we would normally expect. And then secondly, we need to equip the United Nations under Qaeda with the right level of assistance so that he can help the Afghan government, who are still in a developing mode, to be able to coordinate the efforts of the 40-plus countries that are trying to invest in Afghanistan. It is impossible for the Afghan government to do it on their own. We need to offer them that assistance, and the right place to do that is under Qaeda. And so those, I think, are things we just need to bear in mind throughout everything else we talk about. Now, there's some things that Alex asked me to talk about, and I'll just hit those. There is an insurgency in Afghanistan, and we shouldn't ignore that. It is there. And therefore, having some sort of coherent counterinsurgency strategy, which we all understand and all adhere to, is important. But we need to build an Afghanistan in which the Afghans believe themselves. And they are, after all, the centre of gravity of this, the population. And if the population aren't with us, then there's no way of us winning this. So all of that comes back, again, to the communications side of it. And, of course, this is not about killing our way to victory, which a lot of the press pundits seem to think it's something to do with that. Once all the Taliban are dead, then we're okay. Well, that's never going to happen, because the Taliban, majority of the people we talk about Taliban are disaffected youth, the people that Ali was talking about, who are unemployed and somebody's paying them to go and do things. And there's a sort of thought there. And I think if you look at the military side, militarily at the tactical level, the Taliban can't win. But they can win at the strategic level if we don't get our act together. What the history, I think, shows that in 2008, the insurgency has become very concentrated, much more concentrated. Something like 74% of the incidents occurred in 10% of Afghanistan's districts, which actually is only home to 6% of the population. So if the press would report this accurately, we'd have a much better view of what the real issues are. It's not covering the whole country. And I think the other thing that is clear is that the Taliban lack the capacity to hold ground. They're not a formed army. I hate people talking about them like some sort of organized army that we're fighting. They're not. They're a bunch of use an American expression, ragtags, I think, who are coordinated by funding mostly, but not by command and control. And if you look at the activity, it's going back to the same sort of activities that we saw before the last election, whereby they're now going back into asymmetric warfare. They started to kidnap the international community. They started to take on the NGOs. And if you look at what happened in 2005 and late 2004, it's an almost exact replica of that timescale. So what is the solution? And I'm not going to tell you anything new, but it's just worth, again, trying to just draw the strands together to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music. It needs to be a comprehensive approach, and by that, it will include kinetic military activity. There is no doubt about that. But that needs to be provided at the moment by the coalition, and then we need to hand that over as far as possible to the Afghans and put them in the lead on this. So it's an Afghan on Afghan affair and not an international community on Afghan affair. We need, as Ali said, to train the Afghan security forces so they are properly equipped for this activity, and mentor them, and that's actually one of the challenges, is getting enough mentors in the place. And then we need to build politically, both centrally and in the provinces, and provide better livelihoods for the Afghans so that, and it would be much cheaper for us to pay the disaffected youth to do something valuable than it is for us to pay ourselves to go and fight them. And so using them to do effective things like getting the irrigation going so that eventually we can get agriculture going, I think is a sensible way. And then, of course, a reconciliation program needs to be there to tempt in the disaffected, and particularly started at the bottom level rather than at the top level. Let them lay down their arms. But it doesn't mean an unconditional thing, and I'll come back to this. And I really don't. There was a ridiculous story, or from my point of view, a ridiculous story in the Washington Post this week about Hekmatyar being invited back into the government. Well, I just can't contemplate that. It's just not even a realistic proposition for, I think, almost any Afghan, but certainly for the international community. And we need to demonstrate our firm belief in what we're doing, and I'm not sure we've done that. Afghans have been let down too often in the past, and they're just not quite certain whether we're going to let them down again in the future. So coming back to the reconciliation side again, should we talk to the Taliban? Yes, but there are some pretty heavy red lines out there that just need to be obeyed. And we put these red lines down, and Ali and I were involved in this, when the program Taki Misol, the PTS program, was created. And those red lines, I think, are extant and remain there now for anything. So they need to lay down their arms, renounce violence, accept the constitution, and cut all ties with AQ. When they come in, they need to come in unconditionally, because some of them may have extant civil cases or legal cases against them. And the three themes are: this must be Afghan-led. It can't be led by the international community. It must be done from a position of strength. You can't do it when you're in a position of weakness. Otherwise, it's a takeover bid by the people we're most trying to defeat. And it can't be seen as the only way out of it. This is not a silver bullet in its own right. It's just one of the strands, but an important strand that has to be looked at. And then, as Ali said, we have to look at the region, because this is not just an Afghan issue any longer. It covers Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there are other players out there who need to be wrapped into this and become part of the solution and not be part of the problem, like Iran, Russia, China, and India. All have a part to play in this. They all have interests in Afghanistan, some good, some not quite so good, and they need to help us solve it. So what should our aim be? It's to help Afghanistan come to peace with itself, and for them and ourselves to be safe from Al-Qaeda. And we need to help the then build the skill sets to do it because they can't do it on their own. And I think with the new administration, we've got a real administration, a real chance for changing some of the dynamics, and actually persuade the international community to pull in behind a comprehensive approach. And a new president will be able to put out some fairly big asks to the international community. But it needs to be done in a subtle way, and it needs to be done in a coordinated fashion. It is no good going back to the megaphone diplomacy of beating NATO up, because actually that had an entirely negative effect, and there was no additional troops appeared. When the megaphone diplomacy was turned off and bilateral conversations were held, actually the numbers of troops and assistance and aid assistance in Afghanistan has gone up quite significantly. People just don't want to be bullied into doing something, and they want to do it because there is a good purpose for it. And going back to the old adage, you know, the moment the military is pretty much it. The military should be 20% of the solution to this problem, and we need to build up the other 80%. Now, understanding the dynamics of European politics is actually something that this administration is going to have to grapple with pretty quickly, because it is European politics that you're going to be talking about. And without understanding those, I'm afraid there'll be a problem. And I just picked the Germans, and I can't see my German colleagues in the room, but German bashing is a great thing in Afghanistan. And I want to just remind everyone, the Germans are in the north of Afghanistan and doing a good job. If they weren't there, and if we keep on megaphone diplomacy, the Germans are going to do more, and they leave, we're going to have to find someone else to come and replace them. They have just passed through the Bundestag an increase in their ceiling to increase by another 1,000, which is, you know, against all of the odds that you would have thought from the kind of language you read in the press. So there is an ask there for the next president, that is, bring those extra 1,000 into the country and do more in the north. But actually to ask them to come to the south is a completely and utterly irrational thing, because it's not going to happen. The Bundestag will not allow it. So understanding the pressures of politics, I think, is going to have to be a big part for a future administration. So, you know, a subtle, tailored approach is what we would like to see. And I think that would actually produce quite a lot. Now, do we need lots more troops? Well, General McKernan is the commanding general. He says he does, and if he says he does, then he does. And we shouldn't be questioning that. The question is, what does he want to do with those troops? And I think this is where there's a great misunderstanding. The worst thing we could do is to go and secure the whole of Afghanistan and then have no reconstruction coming in. We've done that over the past 7 years. I think going back to Alex's thing, if you go and secure an area and then nothing else happens, then the Afghans look at you and say, well, what's changed? And the answer is nothing, other than they might have a moderately better bit of security, or a different kind of corruption or bribery has come into action. What I think we ought to be doing is to secure areas, bring the aid in, get the Afghans to come in and replace the international community, and then press out further and keep doing that. And gradually we will get the country to a position where the people trust us that we're going to stay there. They not only trust we're going to stay there, they also trust us that we're going to go, because that's another part of the equation which is actually equally as important as the staying the course. And I think if we do that, I'm sure that's where the plan is coming from. And then if you do that, you can have a cycle which is a good cycle. And provided the security is there, then the international community will come in with the aid we require to do the reconstruction, which is so badly needed. So that's it to me, before Alex sends me a note to tell me I've got to stop. I think there's a lot there, and I'm quite happy to answer questions, particularly some of the questions that Alex would rather wish I'd spoken about rather than once here. But I have to be circumspect, because I see my friend from Reuters in the back there. But I don't subscribe to the notion at all that we're losing. I do subscribe to the notion that this has become more difficult. I do subscribe to the notion that we need a better coordination and a better organized structure in the international community to allow the Afghans to build the capabilities they require to be able to rule their own country. And that's going to take some time.
Thank you. Let me just say to a few of you standing, there are a few empty seats. If people could indicate where the seats are, we're going to be going for a while, and I don't want you to wilt. So if you want to take seats, it won't interrupt us. And now we'll turn to Fahim.
There's one here.
There's one here.
All right.
Yeah, certainly.
Thank you, Alex. First, I would like to make this clear that I haven't coordinated my presentation, but Minister Jalali and Major General Peter. But what we are, what I'm talking about, are much more in the same line. But you would may find it a graphic presentation of what my distinguished colleague said. I think in Afghanistan it might not be in a way right to say whether the glass is half full or half empty. But for sure what we can say, we have some water there. So the challenge is how to hold the water. Recent studies in Afghanistan revealed a declining pattern of optimism of Afghan people. And the very recent finding of an international organization, Asia Foundation, said that since 2004 up to 2008, a very steep declining of optimism of people happened. Almost 50%. And they are saying that we are not following the right direction. While in contrast, pessimism of Afghans almost increased threefold. In 2004, 11% of Afghans were saying we were heading to wrong direction. But towards end of 2008, it's almost threefold, 32%. So, okay. Thank you. So why this dichotomy? Since 2004, there has been lots of promising measures and steps towards nation building and state building in Afghanistan. In 2004, Afghanistan experienced its very first direct election, presidential election, in which over 10 million Afghans registered themselves. And contrary to United States election in 2004, over 80 persons voted, while in 2004 in the United States, there were only 64 persons. And surprisingly, 40% of the voters were women. And 2005, Afghanistan, after almost three decades, had its parliamentary and provincial elections, in which 5,000 runners were there, almost 9 to 12% women competitors. It was quite promising. And the Afghan government, for the first time, approved a three-year action plan to deal with war crimes in the past, the action plan called Peace, Justice, and Reconciliation. Effectively, after convening of a parliamentary election, the provision of Bonn Agreement accomplished. So a new phase was needed. So the London Conference, which presented Afghanistan Compact, was another encouraging move, showing the strong commitment of international community for Afghanistan, in which over $10 billion of dollars committed to, for the reconstruction of Afghanistan. And I will come at on this point in the next slide, but there was due emphasis on implementation of the action plan on transitional justice and dealing with war crimes. And on the other hand, Afghanistan Compact emphasized on establishment of a proper vetting mechanisms, particularly for appointment of high-rank officials. Meanwhile, Afghan government was trying to develop its own strategy. Afghanistan National Development Strategy was encouraging, and it was well presented to international community, which was well received. And it was basically mainly on three pillars. Improving security, as Minister Jalali mentioned. Security has been the high rank security priority of Afghans and their top priority and concern. So means to achieve this, mentioned to strengthen Afghan National Army. In addition to that, to support Afghan National Police, professional police, and to enhance DDR process, disarmament, and DIAG, dismantling of illegally armed groups. And lots of rhetorics and good words for good governance to enhance civil and judicial reforms and to have human rights and rule of law at the forefront of the government's activities. And of course, consolidation of democracy based on periodic and constitutional elections. and to enhance simultaneously to these first two pillars, social and economic developments, to enhance access of Afghans to health, to education, to safe water, shelter, and of course, employment and job opportunities. What went wrong? Since still, after 7 years, Afghans are experiencing appalling deterioration of security, increase in numbers of terrorist attacks and activities, as well as growing insurgency. Still, they are observing existence of local militia, and still there are lots of talks to further strengthen local militias and auxiliary police instead of national police. And contrary to that, lots of these warlords, bad guys, are setting up their own security companies. And they're contracted by international organizations to provide them security. In terms of good governance, it's still continuation of impunity and violation of human rights is a common practice. No one has so far been taken accountable. Just a couple of days back, we heard from head of India's National Security Directorate that when they arrested a guy, it was revealed later that he was arrested months before, but he bribed court, then he was released, then again he committed. As Minister Jalali mentioned, rampant corruption is a high concern, and to our eyes, it's a gross violation of human rights. If there is corruption, then you can buy justice. You can, in a way, violate rule of law. So this is high concern. And of course, drug-related business. It's another issue. On the other hand, inadequate or weak political will from the Afghan government to implement its own action plan, which is the 3-year action plan to deal with war crimes. And in terms of economic development, still we see lots of, in a way, economic in a way, disparity and poverty. They're still criminalized in war economies, the dominant feature of the economic arena of Afghan's life. Unbalanced rural and urban development. And as my colleagues highlighted, over 40% rate of unemployment. And in one international conference, Dr. Ashraf Ghani was saying, who is a Talib? A young, unemployed person. So this is a fertile ground to feed, in a way, insurgency. Why? I don't want to much more focus on this, but since most of the things that I wanted to say was really very professionally highlighted by my distinguished colleagues. But however, Afghan government suffers from, in a way, weak leadership. Political deals, compromises after compromises. Into this, it would not be fair to put the blame only on Afghan side. International community should take responsibility. That says they keep their eye and eye blind to it. They keep silent. And the Afghan government so far has not been in a way assertive to human rights and democratic values. So it's why, in a way, we are confused which way we are going. On the other hand, bad governance. Most of the things that we are talking about, they are symptoms of bad governance. And at the international community, as my colleagues mentioned, so absence of a common strategy, since international community as a whole is not one entity. It includes, it covers, in a way, sovereign nation states. They have their own priorities, their own interests. So sometimes they are complementary to each other, sometimes they are parallel, sometimes they are divergent. So it's very important to have, in a way, a comprehensive strategy. And to avoid these ad hoc mechanisms to address issues and to have a well-analyzed strategy and policy for security and development in Afghanistan. And inadequate coordination. It was mentioned. But however, I would like to mention the impact of weaknesses of Afghan government and inability of international community to put things in order while dealing with Afghan government. So in a way, the Afghan people would be the ultimate victims of this. And it would create a golden fertile ground for Taliban insurgents to exploit. And since it would overshadow the authority of Afghan government and the credibility of international community, there will be a wide mistrust gap. So to address this, it's good to focus on the connectors rather than focusing on the dividers. Possible ways out. Nationally, it would be very much important to invest on human security. As Ambassador Jalali mentioned, troop search is really needed at this time, but it should be complemented with development search. At the end of the day, Afghans should think and assess tangible changes in their routine lives. And of course, good governance. A government to be accountable to its people, to be responsive, to be efficient and effective, and transparent, and participatory, as well as consensus-oriented. And regionally, I don't talk on this since it was mentioned. For sure, what we see in Afghanistan, we feel the heat, but for sure, boiling is somewhere else. And the regional cooperation would definitely address the proxy war, which has been practiced in Afghanistan, sadly. And internationally, there should be clear objectives for war on terror. Whether the international forces who are in Afghanistan, they are protecting themselves, or they are there to provide security and safety for Afghans, who they are fighting for and who they are against. And a unified and well-coordinated martial plan, I should say, by international community. The notion of cheap war and cheap peace has not worked anymore. And naturally, if you have cheap inputs, it produces cheap outputs. So is it easy to invest on security or to deal with the consequences of insecurity? I recall what once Kofi Annan was saying, without security you cannot have development, and without development you cannot have have security. But the experience in Afghanistan showed that without human rights you cannot achieve both, and we cannot achieve peace without justice. So this is a clear in a way, laboratory and a post-conflict situation like Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
And now we will turn to Mark to wrap us up before we get to question and answer.
All right. Thank you very much. First, of course, like my colleagues, I'd like to thank the United States Institute for Peace for holding this event and inviting me to be here. Also for allowing me to promote my book shamelessly as well. So I always appreciate on a new stage. Just to say a couple words about the book. It's called Afghanistan Transition Under Threat, and Alex held it up there. There are a couple copies, I believe, still on the table. Unfortunately, I just discovered that the order forms are still on my desk in Canada, so I can't hand those out here today. But you can purchase it on the internet or come to me after, and I can give you my card and I can arrange a sale for you if you'd like. Now, the book, I think it complements Alex's new book and USIP's new book quite well, because we actually do look at the past. We look at the past 7 years and we chart developments in the state building process. Look at the lessons learned, because I think we have to understand those lessons learned in order to look at the future. And we break it down into three different transitions. We view the larger transition in Afghanistan as encompassing three different transitions. That's the political transition, the economic transition, and the security transition. So we take a look at what has happened in the past, the mistakes made, the challenges that have been confronted or overcome, or obstacles that remain. And we do that with an eye to what can happen in the future. I believe we have two authors from the book in the room today. Minister Jalali has authored one of the chapters, as well as I think Seema Patel is there as well, who authored one of the chapters. But other authors include Ambassador Haqqani, the Pakistani ambassador to the United States, authored a chapter before he became ambassador. Professor William Maley of the ANU in Australia, and Professor Antonio Giustosi, or Dr. Antonio Giustosi from the London School of Economics. So I think it's worth taking a look at. Now, I've been asked to speak today about the role of the international community in building up the Afghan security sector. And I'm also going to, within this, come to you from a non-American perspective. I am Canadian and based at a think tank and a university in Canada, and where Afghanistan is the central policy issue, foreign policy issue. It was the central policy issue until the economic crisis, but has been surpassed somewhat since. So it's clear now that security sector reform is the exit strategy for the international community. I think Minister Jalali emphasized that quite well. As your now outgoing president, President Bush, stated in reference to Iraq, when they step up, we can step down. And that's the same logic should apply to Afghanistan. International forces can step down and start to withdraw from the country once the Afghan security forces are capable of assuming responsibility and the mantle for security. Now, we've known the importance of security sector reform for some time to the state-building process. However, despite this reality, the results of the process have been somewhat disappointing. Now, you can always blame resources. There hasn't been enough money, which is true. At times there hasn't, especially in the beginnings of the process. There hasn't been enough mentors, particularly for the police, and that's absolutely correct as well. And there hasn't been enough equipment. But it's more than just a resource issue why the process is faltering. And I'm going to name a few reasons why I think the process is faltering, and it leads us to where I think the process should go. First of all, the process has mainly been framed as a train-and-equip program. Well, that's not quite what security sector reform is, which takes a more holistic look at the security sector and specifically emphasizes governance. There's been, in my opinion, a lack of attention on management structures within the security sector. For instance, the Ministry of Interior. To this day, despite the valiant efforts of Professor Jalali or Minister Jalali when he was there, the right amount of resources was not dedicated from the very beginning in reforming the ministry, the institution that is supposed to manage the police, which today is, I would say most people would admit, is one of the more dysfunctional institutions in the country, despite being one of the most important. It still lacks basic systems that function effectively, like payroll, procurement, logistics. It is faces huge levels of corruption, which, according to one analyst, 80% of the ministry, of the staff of the ministry, are involved on one level or another, direct or indirect, in the drug trade. So this is one of the gaps there. There has to be more of a focus, and you can see this across the security sector, on the institutions, the agencies, the structures intended to manage, provide oversight and accountability over the security institutions. There's also a high level of factionalism we see within these institutions, which has been extremely problematic and is filtered down into the security forces. The second major gap is the justice gap. I think that the justice sector has not received the requisite attention it needs. It's only received a tiny fraction of the money that's been allocated to the security sector as a whole. Now, mind you, it's not as cost-intensive as rebuilding an army or a police force, but it requires more resources, more of a proportional resources, in order to get it up and running. Now, we know from post-conflict reconstruction that the security sector cannot stand on its feet. It can't function effectively unless it has a justice system that is in working order. And that is still a big question mark in Afghanistan today. As was mentioned, there's widespread corruption in the justice sector. For a great deal of time, there was no coherent strategy. There was huge differences, particularly among the Afghan permanent justice institutions, and as well as the different donors who were implementing justice reform programs. Now, there is a strategy now in place after the Rome Conference on justice sector reform in Afghanistan, but I think the jury's still out where we will really see a commitment to this strategy over the long term and see it implemented appropriately. Now, as the justice system is in many ways still in tatters, you see most Afghans, 80 to 90%, looking to traditional justice mechanisms. Yet, despite the importance of this, despite the fact that the majority of Afghans view the formal justice system as too expensive, out of touch with local realities, corrupt, and they're going to the informal justice system. There's been very few programs to look at how you can develop a complementary relationship between the formal and the informal justice system. And I would compliment here USIP, who's done really innovative and pioneering work on this area. It's still, though, in its infancy. And I think that this is an area that the international community should focus on. How do you bring together the informal and formal justice systems? How do you reconcile them? Another issue that's been missing is corrections. This is corrections as the poor man of the security sector reform process. Of all of the surveys that have been done of the correction system in Afghanistan, they found mostly that the vast majority of prisons in the country don't come close to meeting international standards. I always like, whenever I mention corrections, I always recall an interesting incident. In 2004, I was in the office of a UNAMA corrections advisor, and he showed me a cable on his desk, and it was about a prison break that happened in eastern Afghanistan, and it said, prison break at this particular prison, 8 inmates and 3 guards escape. The reality is, I asked the prison advisor, why? How could this be? This is bizarre. And he said, well, the reality is the conditions are so bad, and these guards must remain in these facilities, that even they desire very strongly to get out. So I think that emphasizes the problem here. And there's been very little investment in this area, yet it's so critical. I think when we see the prison break in Sarposa, for example, of course, this was a coordinated attack by insurgents to release their compatriots. But still, I think you can also look at the stability of the prison system, and the lack of stability is one of the reasons why something like that could happen. Now, the third big gap, and this is more looking to the future, and it's been mentioned particularly by Minister Jalali, is the sustainability issue. My figure, which was from 2005, is that security expenditures actually equaled 500% of internal revenue. I'm happy to hear that it's now only 300%. But this is a huge problem. The reality is that even if the most ambitious and optimistic projections about the Afghan economy come true and internal revenue generating capacity come true, they can't afford the security sector that is being built. Now, in a perfect world, we can say that indefinitely international assistance will remain for Afghanistan, but I don't think that is also realistic. And if you examine the history of Afghanistan and external patrons in Afghanistan, when the money dried up in the past, that's when you start to see insurrections and revolts in Afghanistan and the army start to mutiny. So I think, especially when you can't pay salaries. And I think this is something we really should start to think about now. Now, the bottom line is, and this has been mentioned several times, this is a long-term process, and there's been a lot of short-term thinking that's gone on. The hardships and the obstacles that the security sector reform process has faced has prompted many people to say that, well, that creating formal institutions is actually just not feasible. Or they'll say, you often hear, that at least in the short term, we have to find transitional structures to get us through this period that, you know, we can't find in the formal security apparatus. And this leads to my next point, which is you see in numerous press reports, and I was just reading one by Peter Bergen on the way here, that recently NATO reaching out to tribal leaders to empower militias to take a more bold role in security, perhaps arming militias, primarily in the conflict-afflicted areas of the south and east. You hear in the context of the United States, people believe that perhaps you can replicate the Sons of the Soil program in Iraq, part of the Sunni awakening in Afghanistan, by empowering these tribes. The outgoing Canadian commander of Regional Command South in Afghanistan, Major General Mark Lessard, urged his Dutch successor when he just a few days ago passed on command to reach out to local communities, and I agree with him. But he also warned, with this in mind, he warned against cookie-cutter solutions from Iraq or elsewhere. Now, there are many reasons why I think we should be wary of talk of arming tribal groups in Afghanistan. First of all, it's been done before, and that should be made clear. The coalition armed and used proxy militias immediately after the Taliban regime's fall to combat groups, particularly in the East and South, and many of these groups actually manipulated the coalition to fight their own battles and to achieve their own parochial interests. We saw the Afghan National Auxiliary Police, which I think most people believe the ANAP was a failure. We saw that, in my own research, many people I spoke to had intimate knowledge of this program, felt that maybe between one-fifth and one-quarter of the irregular militiamen who were brought into the ANAP were actually Taliban sympathizers. There was no proper vetting mechanism. In essence, you were still empowering different warlord commanders because you were using their troops. Finally, if you even go back to the Najibullah period and look at how the PDPA regime, the communist regime, utilized and employed tribal militia groups, one of the reasons for its collapse was, in fact, many of these groups turned against the regime in the end. So I think that there are some cautionary tales in both the immediate and longer-term history of Afghanistan. Secondly, it's a politically divisive approach. Let's remember that we're talking here mostly about Pashtun tribes in the south and east. Well, I can tell you that many of the northern groupings will not view kindly the idea of rearming the Pashtuns at the same time that they just largely, at least, disarmed symbolically with the DDR process. Many people I spoke to, they refer to any of these type of programs, and one individual, a prominent commander in the north, called the ANAP in the south Karzai's Taliban. And he went on to warn me that we still have our guns as well. So I think that there are extreme also political dangers, and this has to be handled delicately. Thirdly, I think it undermines what was the most expensive DDR program in history, which, although has many faults, did successfully demobilize over 60,000 ex-combatants and collected 40,000 weapons. In this program, ostensibly, you'd be funneling weapons back to the same militiamen that you were just trying to disarm. Finally, I think that we have to understand also that in the 30-year civil war, many of the tribal authority was fractured in many parts of the South and the East. You saw that traditional tribal authority was superseded by and supplanted by warlord power in many areas. Those who accrued power through their access to the illicit economy, their ability to co-opt aid, and so on. So we should ask ourselves, who are these legitimate commanders that we would be dealing with? I'm not saying not to reach out to tribal leaders. Absolutely, that's essential. I'm not saying not to look to the informal system. In the justice sector, I'm encouraging that. I'm just saying that there is need for very careful thought on how this is done, particularly when you talk about empowering militias. Just on the way ahead, a few remarks. On the police, I think that this is one of the key areas that has to be focused on improving the police. I was very encouraged on my last trip to Afghanistan looking at CSTC Alpha's focused district development program, which goes into communities, takes out the local police, trains them at a local training center, and replaces them with the Afghan Civil Order Police, a more professional force, until that newly trained group, local group, can return. It has shown many gains, and I think should be the way forward, this type of model district program. I think that the success of the Afghan Civil Order Police, though, also shows that maybe there's some room for, as Minister Jalali was saying, to start about thinking about restructuring the police, maybe focusing more attention on this better trained national police that could be deployed elsewhere in the country. Apparently, the local population were shocked to find out how actually a professional police is supposed to act. They had been so used to their local predatory police. I think there's time to talk about perhaps a paramilitary police who can do some of the counterinsurgency work, like a gendarmerie, rather than throwing community police into the breach, which they're not trained to do. Secondly, in terms of the Afghan National Army, I think although it's one of the success stories of the process, I think we have to also think innovatively about what are ways to accelerate the development. I don't necessarily agree with some of these ideas, but I think one of them that has come out recently is the idea of a reserve force, which would allow the establishment of greater capacity, increased numbers, without necessarily looking to mobilize and empower non-state actors. Now, I'll just conclude with a couple remarks. Canada is pulling out our troops, we're pulling out our troops in 2011. Our government says that we are basing this target because this is when we believe the Afghan security forces will be capable of assuming the job in places like Kandahar. I think this is wishful thinking and partially a political game, I must say. But we have to remember that surely progress has been made in the security sector. But the Afghan security institutions are not capable today of assuming this role, and I don't think they'll be capable of assuming a full security responsibility for many years to come. We have to be prepared to remain in this advisory and support role and continue to provide full assistance for some time. But I think in order to accelerate and to ensure this happens in as short a period as possible, we have to revise our priorities. We have to think longer term, and we have to adjust our direction where things aren't working. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. I think that that was a fascinating overview. What we are going to do now is take questions at both sides of the microphone. Unfortunately, because we're recording this, I'm going to have to ask people to stand up and speak. Let me just start off by throwing a question maybe to the first three panelists, just to give a brief comment on Mark's point about tribal militias. We are at a phase in Afghanistan, in many ways because of Iraq, but also because of Afghan and Pakistani history, that people are looking at the failure to develop central institutions quickly enough to fill the security gap. There is a gap. And so the question is, does it make sense in any way to rely on local forces to provide security? Is there any possible program that you can imagine in which that would be a good idea, or do you think that it is a potential short-term gain with a much higher long-term cost, as Mark pointed out? Brief answers, because we're going to have a lot of questions, I think.
Thank you. This is a very important question. Unfortunately, these days, some experts or policymakers think that if something works in one area, it will work in somewhere else. In Afghanistan is a very different society than Iraq. In Iraq, the insurgents were foreigners, and also there was sectarian fighting. In Afghanistan, the insurgents are part of the society, Taliban. And on the other hand, the tribal structure of Afghanistan has transformed in the past 30 years. Yes, in the past, the tribes and communities help government to establish or help or complement state security institutions to respond to security challenges in the country. In the 70s, early 70s, I was involved in Paktia province to settle dispute between two tribes. I used both the tribal structure and also the formal institution of the country. They were complementing, they were not defining each other. However, the situation in Afghanistan is totally different. Yes, there is room for mobilizing communities in order to stand against the insurgents and terrorists, because in Afghanistan, about 75-80% of people do not want Taliban to come back. They do not see Taliban as an alternative. However, they are reluctant to stand against them on behalf of a government that can neither protect them nor deliver services to them. So we have to shape the environment first to do that. Now, today, those who are in rural areas, in tribal areas, powerful, either in some areas still you have traditional leaders of the communities, in some areas people with gun and money or people who have links with extremist groups, either inside the country or outside the country. You cannot mobilize them the same way that you did 30 years ago. So therefore, you have to go on a case by case, different parts. Now, I'm very disappointed when some experts in the West take one old terminology and they read too much into it. Arbakai, they call it. Arbakai is not a tribal army. It is not a fighting force. It's a law enforcement mechanism in only in some tribes in the east, in Paktia, Paktika, and Khost, not in the south, not in Ghazni, not in Zabul, not in Helmand. They don't know what Harbakai is. Harbakai actually is a small group of tribal police that implements or enforce the decision of a jirga. The fighting force is Lashkar. So therefore, it's only in one area. So now, everywhere I said, okay, let's create Arbakais in Afghanistan. In some areas, maybe that will work in Paktia. But in other areas, you do not have this. So there, you have to go case by case. I think if you create militias, you deprive, you actually undermine two assets in Afghanistan. First of all, either you have a professional state institutions that can work, or you have tribal structures. Militia is neither one. Militia does not have the discipline of a professional army or professional police. It does not have the capacity of tribal, solidarity and tribal enthusiasm and devotion. So therefore, it is in between, and over time, it turns into criminal group. It happened in the past, it will happen today. Even as we speak, last week I heard in Kabul, they created two militia battalions in Farah after deterioration of security in that area this year. Two battalions, one in Bakwa, one in Farah. And unfortunately, they were created from Barakzai tribes, which is a minority in Farah. Nurzais are the majority. So what they did, they went onto Nurzais. In Farah, much of environment violence that took place this year was tribal violence. It was not only Taliban. Yes, Taliban was there too. So therefore, one has to be very careful. Today, the elements that can help create community security mechanism are people with influence. These are either former Mujahideen commanders with good name who were not involved in interfighting, or religious leaders who are either in the area or they were displaced, or in some areas are tribal leaders, and also in Afghanistan there are certain families that they actually earn respect of people. They can be served as a magnet. If you help them, protect them, they can create that kind of a structure. But not as a militia, as a tribe, as a community, to work within that traditional mechanism of the community. If you take, for example, Mangals can do this because Mangal knew how to do it. Mangals will take turn all these different clans of tribes. They will contribute to a force, to a lashkar, and then they replace them with others. That mechanism works only in the tribal context. My opposition to militias in 2004 actually succeeded. I actually won the argument against the Ministry of Tribal Affairs, who wanted to create militias. And I was for empowering tribes, empowering the traditional mechanism of tribes. I wish we did that at that time. The situation was totally different at that time. So therefore, I am for, empowering community capacities to help establish security and stabilization, but in the context of the traditional and now current situation in Afghanistan. So,
thanks. Do you have anything to add to that?
Just very quickly, I was involved in trying to disarm a whole lot of tribal militias, and it's actually quite difficult because they don't like being disarmed, because once they've got their arms and they've got them legally, they then become part of the corruption. And so I would subscribe, I think, to what Ali has said, is that the international community don't understand the tribal pressures in Afghanistan and cannot, I think, come up with a template that works across the country, because it's just not the case. It just won't happen. And therefore, we need to deal with this on a case-by-case basis. I think we do have a problem, which we need to work out how we deal with, which is until we have trained and less corrupt police that can be deployed, we need to create circumstances that the Afghan people feel more secure within. And therefore, I would subscribe, I think, to this being a more of the things Ali's talking about, community security, empowering the tribes, Not arming them. They don't need to be armed to carry out this security, and that's sort of one of those things that everyone in Afghanistan always wants, is more arms. There are plenty of them there. And we need to make sure that we have a process whereby the tribes understand that this is a pro-tem issue, and that eventually the police will be trained and will come in and replace them, and then the tribes will then still have a responsibility for the tribal area, but not actually be in charge of that security. So I think it is difficult, and if you get it wrong, you just end up with more problems and greater difficulties in disarming them later.
Do you want to add to that, Finn?
Yes, very important question, but I think it very much depends what objective you are having in your mind. For example, if you think that it's good to have in a way islands of government within government and to promote tribalism and to have tribal government, this is the best mechanism available, go for it. But if we think of an inclusive, national, responsive government, this is apparently not working. Thank you.
Okay, so first question, if you could identify your name and ask the question.
I'm Jared Boyle with the Service.
Sir.
And my question is really aimed at sort of eliciting a broader political strategic context here from the panel. No one has really talked about the strategic rationale for why American people specifically should continue to fight in Afghanistan, as they, you know, have made a political decision to get out of Iraq after 6 years, five years. No one has really articulated, but I'd like to have explain why this is a strategic interest of the United States that demands a war for an indefinite period of time. And in your answer, if you could deal with the potential objection that the lesson of Iraq was that before U.S. troops went in there was not an al-Qaeda threat. The al-Qaeda threat arose in the context of the U.S. military occupation. If this is a long-term proposition, why isn't there a basis for viewing military occupation over the two or three years as a net negative rather than a positive in terms of potential al-Qaeda?
Interesting question. Why don't we reverse order this time, and I'll let you start off, Mark.
This is a question. Why are we there is a question that I'm constantly asked in Canada. In terms of our public opinion, it's about 50-50. We should be there or we shouldn't. Here's a few of the points I give. First of all, there is a compelling security reason to be there, international and regional. Now, in terms of international, the difference with Iraq is al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan prior to Iraq. I mean, we know that September 11th and so on was planned there. It was not only just in Afghanistan, but it was al-Qaeda actually had a position within the Taliban state, in a sense. I think that part of this is about preventing the vacuum that would most likely emerge if this state would collapse. And I would be one of those who would say that if there was a precipitous international withdrawal from Afghanistan today, that we would see the collapse of the state in Afghanistan. That's what I would posit. Okay. So I think that this is about preventing that sort of vacuum, which would undoubtedly be filled by numerous non-state armed groups and so on, which pose a distinct threat to the international community, terrorist organizations, as well as transnational criminal organizations. Secondly, I do think that this is an important, from a Canadian perspective, but I think from an American perspective as well, I think this is an important case for NATO in particular. So I think that this is the first major out-of-area operation. If you go back to the credo of out-of-area or out-of-business for NATO. And I think this is a test case for it. And I think from a Canadian perspective, and I think from an American perspective, it's important not to see NATO fail here. So I think that there are compelling reasons in that regard. I mentioned also regional security. And I think this is obviously a very important part of the world. You have Pakistan, which has distinct threats next door. I think it's important to set an example regionally Part of stabilizing the border area of Pakistan is also stabilizing Afghanistan. So I think that will contribute as well. And I think, personally, I think you can't forget about some of the humanitarian and historical reasons for being there, which are also quite profound.
Fahim, if you just have anything to add.
I fully endorse what Mark said, but I think it's because of a strategic mistake that the United States made in Afghanistan in early 1990s, while abandoning a country to emerge into a degenerating war. So they need to fight unless they are confident that there is no any source of threat toward region security and the world's peace and stability.
So you're not obviously an historian, and I would recommend you read the history of Afghanistan carefully, because I think there's some pretty serious misunderstandings in your question, which is this is non-discretionary for the West.
I heard you say that.
It is non-discretionary, and if you look at the history of terrorist activities over the last few years, you would have been able to trace most terrorist activities, and particularly 9/11, to the ungoverned space in Afghanistan until such time as the international forces came there. If you now have a look at the history of where the majority of terrorist activities are generated, it's the ungoverned space in Pakistan.
Doesn't that change the strategic
significance? I don't think it changes the strategic significance at all, because this is an area that requires stability, it requires help, it requires investment. There is no similarity with Iraq here, in my view, and I think there's a great danger if we start to draw those similarities. The issue I think we have is that if we leave, there's almost certainly to be a collapse in Afghanistan at the moment. We have not yet got the Afghan security forces to a point where they can take control of the situation, and if there's a collapse in Afghanistan, I am pretty certain that you'd find a similar activity happen in Pakistan as well. And that would not be an interest of the world. It certainly would not be an interest of this nation or my nation. And so I think that this is a very important activity for all of us.
Anything to add to that?
Yes, I think what you are suggesting, your approach was taken by the United States and the rest of the world in 1991, actually, after the Soviet withdrawal and the breakup of the Soviet Union, and paid a high price for it. Because that abandonment of Afghanistan was a broken nation. It lost 1.5 million of its population. The state was broken. With this war, which became the last battlefield of the Cold War, two superpowers were fighting. And when the Soviet Union broke up, everybody walked away from a broken nation. That approach that you are suggesting. But then what happened in that vacuum? That vacuum filled by those who were the responsible for the criminal attacks in New York and Washington. So therefore today I've said, apart from these strategic issues, I think there's a moral obligation, I think. It's a sad lot of Afghanistan that always served as a battlefield of ambitious powers. I think if you read that book of Arnold Toynbee, Between Ox and Gemini, it says this country is listed under highway streets, always it was the battlefield of somebody and suffered there. In 19th century, its borders were imposed by two major empires in order to make it a buffer state. That buffer state actually played that role, blocked that clashes between two titans. But that small country had to fight both in the 20th century. In the 1990s, the British Empire, and then the end of the century, the other successor of the other empire. In both cases, it suffered a lot. Today also suffered during the Soviet occupation. Soviet occupation was not only an occupation. It was a battlefield of the Cold War between two superpowers, which Afghanistan suffered. If today there is also talks about grand deal, give something to this and that, and then just to bring peace, I think this country will suffer again. Apart from all these strategic issues that my colleagues actually mentioned, I think it is a moral obligation for the world. And, as a footnote, I should say that the international community, the United States, did not go to Afghanistan in 2001 to rebuild that country. It went to destroy the network of Al-Qaeda, which was responsible for criminal acts in New York and Washington. And then state building Afghanistan came as an afterthought. That's why it wasn't complete. Thank you.
I just want to add one thing that I think is interesting. I think it was reflected a little bit in Mark's answer, but I think that there is a difference in opinion between, in many ways, with exception of some of the continental European governments that are engaged in the South, there is a sort of division between the Anglo alliance of Canada, the UK, United States, and Australia to some extent, and I think that the Danish and the Dutch are also somewhat on board with that perception. But then there's also a continental European perception, which I think is voiced by a lot of people that I've spoken to that don't believe that believe that this was supposed to be a peacekeeping mission and not a war fighting mission, and that what is seen, and in fairness, is what is seen by many people in the region, and particularly in Pakistan, as Western aggression in the region, is something that pushes people to fight, as opposed to pushing them towards peace. And so while I certainly agree with the panelists, there is another perspective out there, and I think that it's very important for the next administration, which I think was said early on in this discussion, to try and harmonize and find convergence in Western views and indeed global views about the importance of Afghanistan and Pakistan to the world, because I think that this divergence is causing not only dissonance at the global level, but it's actually hurting our operations on the ground. Please.
Thank you. My name is Said Zafar Hashmi from Voice of America Afghanistan Services, and I have two questions. First of all, with noticing this deteriorating security situation in Afghanistan, as well as the election coming on the way, do any of you believe that Afghanistan will have or will witness a democratic, free, fair, and well-participated election? And second question is, there is a growing concern after Obama's win in the presidential elections in the U.S. in Pakistan, from his approach, what he was saying during the campaign trail. What do you think of that? Does it have a practicality or no? And how will be his approach toward Pakistan and Afghanistan? Thanks.
Ali, any feelings to share about the coming election?
Well, I think the election is the constitution of Afghanistan, actually calls for elections after 5 years. And I think it will be a major mistake to think that election should not take place in Afghanistan. Yes, there are challenges, security challenges, and however, I think the idea should be to prepare the environment in order to hold elections, not to actually make everything subject to the current situation in Afghanistan. I think it is very important, the election, that actually brings legitimacy to the system. Otherwise, it will be a step back, maybe many step back, from what we have achieved during the past 7 years. People think about other mechanisms, Louis Jarga, others. I think they are not good substitute for the, you know, elections that is legal, that is part of the constitution of Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm very optimistic because even in some very difficult areas in Afghanistan, the voter registration process is going very well. And so far in the past 1 month, 1.5 million new voters actually were registered for. So therefore, so far, intimidation was there by the insurgent Taliban, but still people actually went and registered themselves for voting. And with regards to Pakistan, I think Afghanistan is, unfortunately, the battleground of four conflicts. It is India-Pakistan conflict. It's Iran's opposition to United States. It is Russian conflict with NATO. And also inside Afghanistan, the conflict inside. So Afghanistan is influenced by all these conflicts. So therefore, a regional solution is something that should be supported. Regional solution by Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, all these countries that can do something like what happened in Dayton for Balkans. Those countries who have a stake in the situation should be brought together in order to find a way that actually secures cooperation of all these countries. It is difficult, it should be long, however, this should not be excluded. Peace in Afghanistan cannot be achieved without cooperation from these regional powers. Today, neighbors are interfering in Afghanistan. Traditionally in Afghanistan, all wars, all conflicts were started by intervention, through intervention from foreign countries, from neighbors particularly. So therefore, I think attacking Pakistan or hitting that could be part of the overall strategy. I think the best way is to make Pakistan convinced that this is not only an American war, this is a war for themselves too. They are not fighting an American war. They are not fighting an Afghan war. They are not fighting a war with somebody else. This is also their own war. Therefore, their cooperation should be, you know, secured in this country. In India too, the same thing.
Just very quickly, I think there's always a misunderstanding that Afghanistan is a very tribal country and therefore the people aren't nationalistic. If you go on the north of the Durand line, which of course is not recognised by Afghans, you'll find people think they're Afghans. If you go on the south of the Durand line, you'll find people who think they are Pakistanis. And I think the lesson we need to learn to answer part of that question is that we all assume that it was impossible to run elections in the Fatah in Pakistan. And the elections were run there and they were deemed to be fair enough, whatever that means, but they were deemed to be reasonably democratic. And therefore, I do believe that there are opportunities. And I think the electoral registration issue that is going on at the moment is a very good lesson. I mean, there are hundreds of people, millions, as Ali said, coming in and registering, and relatively little interference. So I think the Afghan people will want to have election. I think it's important there is an election. On your own internal politics, I shall leave that for someone else to comment on.
I think to talk about fair and free election, it might be very, in a way, unrealistic and optimistic, if we recall what happened in 2000 election in the United States. But however, in a country like Afghanistan, to have a relative fair and free election and genuine election, it would be very promising. But it requires lots of, in a way, other measures to be in place. While security is the core issue, the government should be, in a way, honest to do a national census, in a way to address gerrymandering concerns and to define clear electoral constituencies. On the other hand, the international community can supplement these efforts of the Afghan government by providing required resources, to have monitors, to have technical advisors. So these are very complementary. And as Minister Jalali mentioned, now it's constitutional election. No one has the authority to postpone or delay or to scrap the election. So it's a very democratized and to enhance democratization in Afghanistan, it's a new discipline. Instead of turning to violence, let's practice it. Let's encourage Afghans to utilize peaceful means of power transition and to enhance their political participation.
We have to, technically speaking, the international community is very good at holding elections. Costs a lot of money, but we can, I say we because in the end, it's probably going to come to international observers and so on. From what I understand, the Afghan authorities are having some difficulties putting things together for this election. I think what the hope is, and I think if we see it, the last election, from what one election observer prominent told me, he said, well, everyone cheated, but it lit pretty much equally, so it balanced itself out. Or I think President Karzai, who said, when someone said Afghans were voting multiple times, he said, this just it shows that Afghans are enthusiastic about democracy. So he said, let them vote, which is an interesting approach. What's most needed out of this election, this presidential election, is a legitimate second candidate. What I mean by that is, if we look at the last election, the other candidates mostly represented narrow ethnic constituencies, not necessarily narrow. And if you actually look at the breakdown of the votes, President Karzai was the only one to get any votes outside of his own ethnic constituency, the Pashtuns being the others. Mostly, the votes they took in pretty much resembles the last, broadly speaking, the census, the previous census we had in 1979 figures. So I think if we see a legitimate other candidate, to see a real race in that way, two people who can earn votes across ethnic lines, I think that would be extremely positive. Just very briefly about Pakistan, I think it's necessary to be quite careful in terms of in dealing with Pakistan, the sort of the new momentum and media coverage now that we see of perhaps intervention into the tribal areas, sometimes perhaps without the authorization of the Pakistani government. I think we still have to consider that this is a new government which is still finding its footing, and so I think that there is a lot of different levers of pressure that can be used. Without necessarily resorting to forceful means in this sort of way. I know that there's probably people who understand this, the Pakistani side, quite better than me, so I encourage someone to comment on that.
Thank you.
Megan Catt with CNA. I actually have two questions. The first, General, you had talked about the need for improving strategic communications, which I completely agree with. And I was wondering if you or anyone else on the panel could possibly elaborate and have any specific recommendations on how to do so. And the second, everyone spoke about the need to train, equip, monitor the ANP. And I was just wondering if anyone had any insight as to, after going to training, if there have been any improvements with corruption and human rights abuses.
Great. Do you want to start, Colin? Did you want to start?
No. Okay.
We can go in reverse order.
Go for it. Well, strategic communication, this is a question that usually I've been asked several times. But the problem is that unless you bring deeds and words together, no strategic communication works. People believe things when they see them. Particularly in Afghanistan, which is a very traditional society, very, very, they have seen so many things and they would believe things. It's like, it's a Missouri, show me state?
Yeah.
So it is show me state. Yeah, it's like that. If you, in during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, usually you would have, when people heard from Kabul or Afghanistan radio that there was a rally and host in support of the government, people will think there was fighting. So this is what. Unfortunately, there is no connection between the what is going on and what we say. Therefore, unless we bring these two together, strategic communication would not work in Afghanistan, at least. When people see that there are civilian people dying because of the bombardment, and because the lack of troop protection takes precedence over human security, then people will not believe that these troops are here to help Afghans. So therefore, this is a very complicated issue. You can spend millions of dollars on communications, but in the only one bombing of civilians can undermine the whole thing. So therefore, I think it is. People should believe believe things when they see it. When you see that the international forces go and search homes, and then they violate the sanctity of homes of Afghans and villages, what do you think? No matter how much you tell them that we are here to help you, build a bridge there, and build a school, that village will not forget that thing. So therefore, it is a very comprehensive, you have to have a very comprehensive approach. Strategic communication does not stand by itself. It is part of an overall strategy. You have to do it. And what was the other question?
AMP.
How reliable
has training improved the corruption and human rights record of the AMP?
That was in 1975.
Human rights?
Has training improved the the corruption problem and human rights record of the ANP?
The corruption of ANP is a reflection of an environment. As long as a police chief in a province does not know how long he will be in that post, if there's no job security, is there no merit promotion, as long as appointments are politicized, nothing is going to help. Because people think, okay, I'm here for a week, and then let's think about my rainy days. Training is not going to help that. So you have to give people some kind of a guarantee, some job security, and merit promotion, and depoliticized appointments. Then that will help, not training.
I'll just make a very quick comment. The truth is that the truth does not sell newspapers. And so when something's going well in Afghanistan, it's very quiet in the newspapers. And when something's going bad in Afghanistan, it is very, very well reported. And somehow we have to break that paradigm, because it's not actually helping either the international community or the Afghan people. And therefore we do need some form of methodology that will help us get this message out. It should preferably be an Afghan message, not an international community message. It should preferably be one that is led by the president. And I would only just highlight that we're going to go through quite a difficult period at the moment as we go through an electoral process. It has already started, and we were having a conversation about this just last night. There can be a tendency, if you have no other electoral basis to stand on, to blame the international community for all the woes you have, and therefore if we don't improve as an international community in our strategic communications, we're going to go through a pretty rocky period between now and whenever the election is.
Yeah, Fahim, you've been involved with training the security forces. If you have anything to say about how effective human rights training is for the security forces.
One of my colleagues was saying, when he was traveling to the office, he realized that a traffic police was beating a driver. And since all the colleagues who were coming to the office, they were representing human rights activists and staff of Human Rights Commission, they were very annoyed and embarrassed. And as a driver, to go to police traffic, not to beat the driver, at least in front of them. And when they asked the driver, the traffic police not to beat the driver. He said, I attended 3 months human rights course. I know what to do. Mm-hmm. So sometimes this is it would be naive only to focus on trainings, just in short-term courses, since and the trainings should not focus how to shoot, but to equip the national police and all security forces to the spread of policing, how to protect civilians. But one of the encouraging move, I should, it's not in a way of flattering to Minister Jalali when he was Minister of Interior, the very first ministry who established human rights unit within the entire structure of a ministry was Ministry of Interior. The second achievement was to include human rights in the teaching curriculum of police academy. For almost 1 year, we were seconding our, in a way, trainers to teach a national police. And afterwards, they took over. Apparently, it doesn't work. But we hope that this is, in a way, part of, in a way, a structure and systematic approach to be insistently and consistently followed up. Thanks.
Okay. In terms of strategic communications, I won't say too much. I agree completely with Minister Jalali. I think, in a way, it's about, to a large degree, about actions. And I think part of the Taliban strategy, of course, is to draw the international community into the NATO, into the type of airstrikes that are alienating so many Afghans. And of course, with every airstrike, with every Afghan you kill, you create, a multiple of 5 or 6 enemies who family members and so on or more. So these are incredibly destructive. And so I think efforts to try and deal with that, which are very difficult, and I understand the difficulties that NATO military contingents face in that regard. I think, though, it can be admitted, and I think a NATO official told me that, frankly speaking, the international military forces are losing the propaganda war against the Taliban. The Taliban have an advantage that no matter what happens, they claim responsibility if it's in their favor, as many terrorists and many insurgent organizations do. They have shown themselves to be much more skillful at exploiting modern technology and media sources than people thought they would be. So I think that certainly I'm not an expert in how to deal with this, but certainly there is some improvement is needed in how to counter the messages that are being emitted by the Taliban. Now, in terms of the police, it's a very good question, because I think that there's a real gap in terms of how do you measure progress. What are the measures of effectiveness? I think if you look at how the United States has measured progress in terms of the security forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's been usually we've trained this many people, we've provided this many guns. It's a numbers game. And frankly, that certainly does not show the effectiveness of the security forces. If you actually go a little deeper, if you look at Iraq in particular, if you look at actually readiness levels, and the same in Afghanistan, the readiness levels are very low. Very few of the security forces are actually capable of undertaking operations independently in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It doesn't measure things like corruption and so on. So I think that there has to be more efforts to develop more nuanced and more textured measures to determine. Now, I think from what I understand from one of your colleagues at the Independent Human Rights Commission, that the numbers of complaints about police have actually gone down. At least that's what I was told a year ago by one of your colleagues. That would be a good measure, in my view, of perhaps there has been some progress in that regard. But I think that you have to start creating mechanisms to gauge civilian attitudes to their willingness to talk to the police, their willingness, the police's ability to actually adequately implement the training. That will take mentors, that will take other sorts of mechanisms. But I think that we're still need to develop these type of things, because at the moment it's either numbers or it's very anecdotal, the evidence we have to determine where these structures are going. Thanks.
I think we are coming to the end of our time, so I'll ask Chantal for a final question.
Yeah, my name is Chantal Louvat from USIP. Many observers have mentioned the importance of the regional approach, and I think some of you as well. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit what such a regional approach would look like. What would be your recommendation for the new administration? Should this be a conference of all the regional powers? Should we engage in kind of OSCE type of process? What type of practical measures would you recommend?
Can
you just complement that question?
Sure.
Of course, the regional approach is very important, but I think there is so much divergence of interest between the competing parties. Like we have talked about China, India, Iran, Pakistan. They're all competing against each other. So what should be the basis? What are those conditions on which you can have a convergence of interest, and is it possible, or is it a sort of unrealism also? And my second question is that, of course, you have talked about a very liberal approach, economic reconstruction and the political reconstruction of the whole state, but that requires hundreds and billions of dollars, and I don't see that much amount coming forward for this process, and that too over a very long period of time. So in case of if the economic aid is not there, or the aid for reconstruction is not there, how are we going to achieve that goal?
Okay, so in reverse order, Mark, we have about a minute each left if you have any words of wisdom.
I think that there is some precedent for some regional cooperation. If you look at the 6+2 agreements, and I think some of my colleagues probably have more, maybe Alex, I think you were in Afghanistan during this period, so you'd probably be better placed to talk about this than I. But I agree with you. And I mean, I was in India not too long ago, and my Indian colleagues who I was talking to had basically, I was quite surprised, had already announced the failure of the Afghanistan mission. And we couldn't come to an agreement on what would be a basis for cooperation after long, long discussions. So, but I think that it's absolutely necessary to try and create some sort of framework, at least for more stable levels of communication between the different actors, because right now that doesn't even exist. The second question is, just very briefly, I think we have to maintain realistic goals. in terms of economic reconstruction. I don't think the goals have been realistic from the very beginning, with some of the broad pronouncements made by the international community about how quickly reconstruction would take place, the short-termist approach that's been taken. I think that if we take a long-term approach, some of this we have to understand there's been tremendous progress has been made, actually, on an economic and development level. There's huge challenges, but tremendous progress has been made. So I think if we adjust our expectations and see this as more of a long-term process of development and reconstruction, where we are trying to empower Afghan actors, that being the key effort, to build the capacity of the Afghan public and private sector to generate growth and so on, then we see some growth is possible.
I think it very much depends to the neighboring countries of Afghanistan to develop their foreign policies in a way to promote regional cooperation. If they are obsessed with fight with this country or that country, they are always trying to explore strategic depths. So this is very much, in a way, important to simultaneously and concurrently work with the neighboring country of Afghanistan in a way to lessen the source of the perceived threats, since if Afghanistan is a stable and peaceful country, definitely all neighboring countries would benefit from that. All of their commercial goods would be coming to Afghanistan, a good market, and lots of cultural, in a way, commonalities. So in a way, this would enhance historical and cultural interaction. So this very much depends how to focus on these bases. Thank you.
And just very quickly, I think that there are not, I mean, obviously, I think we all agree the regional approach has to be had, and how you get there is actually the real complex. And I don't have any great answers for you, I'm afraid. But I think strong US leadership is required, because you need to knock some quite powerful people's heads together, and you are the people who have the purse strings that can actually, if you put a bit of conditionality on how you are liberal with your aid, that will actually help some people concentrate their minds a touch. I think there are some models out there that might be worth looking at. We have to wait and see how the Friends of Pakistan meeting develops and how that goes, but that might be a model that might actually start to bring some of the actors in that actually have an interest in the area and are interfering in one's ability. And Ali's mentioned most of the countries, but there are some countries still interfering in the woodwork there. I think the expanding the Jirga, the Jirga's now only sat twice. If we can do that more regularly and then broaden it out to bring in some extra activities, I think that would help. But advice to the government here, I think there's some structural issues in this country which need to be sorted out. I mean, the NSC does not allow for a regional approach to be taken to this area. If you only have a look at the structure of the NSC, you can see that. I think the same goes for the State Department. So until you do a little bit of internal structural reform, it's not possible for people here to see this as a regional issue. They see it as in stovepipes, and I think that would help. And then with strong US leadership following, a bit of conditionality on the aid would start to make it work a bit better.
Hmm. Well, just briefly, yes, as I said, this regional cooperation or trying to create or support a regional framework is difficult. It's not easy, but it's possible. Go back to 2001 in Bonn, that there was a consensus. It's a consensus. All these countries, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, Europe, they were just in consensus to stabilize Afghanistan. Why we cannot go back to the same kind of status? It is difficult, but it is possible. On the other hand, with the money, he said, I think the money, the amount is not important. How you spend the money in Afghanistan is important. So far, $32 billion were committed, pledged. Half of it was committed, and half of that was actually disbursed. But then more than 80% of it went to contractors and subcontractors. So it is how you build that capacity in Afghanistan. So far in 7 years, money was spent, but capacity was not created in Afghanistan. And the countries who were helping Afghanistan, they helped them on the basis of what they wanted. So that help was supply-driven, not demand-driven. And in 2003, we were focusing and appealing to the international community that we have to have priorities. And all these countries should invest in these priorities, national priorities of Afghanistan, which was infrastructure at that time. Water, roads, and electricity. This was the thing. But many countries were reluctant to invest in major macroeconomic projects. They were just doing small things, which actually were transient, not coordinated, and did not create that national capacity. So it is not the amount of money that we are concerned. It's how you spend that money, how you allocate, how you commit that money for them. Thank you.
Well, I think that this has been a tremendous tour de force. I can only say that when you have a minister, a general, a human rights campaigner, and a scholar all fundamentally agreeing on the principles and priorities, I think that that is fantastic progress. So if we can implement half the ideas, I think, that have come out here today, we'll all be doing much better. Please join me in thanking our panelists. Thank you all for coming, and thanks to the great USIP staff for making this all work. Have a good day.